It's thinking, it's thinking. All right. I do believe we are live.
Okay. Yay.
So anybody who's already on, you're here for Gen Lions. We all know that. Oh, we're gonna get here. Gotcha. Sorry, it waits till I go live for me to see that little checking, waving thing there going on.
Right.
I was like, I was not ready for that. You are, if we don't count Brian Freeman, who mainly came back because I screwed up the audio on his original interview. You are my first repeat guest, so welcome back.
Oh,
totally appreciate that. We're actually going to get into some questions about writing this time. Last time, I was so excited, I just kind of jumped right into talking about the books. But we've got a new book out, and I've already done a review for it. So if anybody watches my channel, they already know how I feel about the book. But we're going to take a minute. We will get there, I do promise you. One question that I've added that was not when I first talked to you, but I ask everybody now, what is the Gen Lions supervillain origin story, a.k.a. why a writer, why an author?
Mm. Well, I was always a writer. I just didn't know it. I've always been very heavily involved with tabletop role playing in various guises. And I was that player who would turn in like the 5,000 word background essay to the DM or GM, along with the illustrations and the floor plan of the house and the background origin story. I mean, just the tome about a character. That was just what I did, right? I was always like making these overly elaborate backgrounds and writing stuff up that happened in game and just doing all of this sort of long form writing. I just wasn't thinking of it as being a writer, and I wasn't thinking of it as something that put into a book. And then my ex-husband dared me to write a book. And so I said, all right, I will.
That's the worst dare you can accept.
And I did, and I caught the bug. Even then, it still took quite a while for me to make that connection from I've written a book to I'm a writer. I'm getting around. I think maybe I might be a writer.
I think after as well, especially as A Chorus of Dragons did, I feel like you have to consider yourself an author these days. You have made it. You're not just writing, bios for fun in your spare time. One of the things I did want to ask you about, obviously anybody who knows anything about Chorus of Dragons knows that started kind of as a D&D campaign that you just put on steroids and turned into a full-blown series. By the way, Sky on Fire, July 9th, everybody. This is the one that we're going to be talking about. Did the Sky on Fire also have that sort of a background, or did you just approach it the same way, or is it completely different?
Yep. Sky on Fire was ground up. Started on it fresh from scratch with absolutely no, it was not any tabletop RPG. There was nothing that came into it. I didn't recycle any characters. The world building was from scratch.
I'll get to it when we get to the book. I did notice some similarities in the kind of the way that you did things, but yes, they are completely different. We will get into that.
I'm going to call myself a liar here. There was one carryover, but I'll talk about that. I'll talk about that later. There was one thing that carried over.
Now, knowing that you built this from the world, from the ground up, and that you do always put so much effort into this, are you a planner or a pantser in the idea of do you just start writing the book, or do you have to outline and everything first?
I'm a milestoner.
Okay. I'm not sure I know what that is. Go for it.
What that is it's a happy medium between those two, right? So I have a series of goals that I will set up for myself in terms of plot I need to get to this point. I need to get to this point. Here's where this needs to happen. How I get from those, from one milestone to the next, that is not necessarily set in stone. So, because what I found out, and I know I'm not alone in this, there's a lot of writers who've talked to me about how dissatisfied they are with those terms because neither one of them adequately describes their process. That if I outline everything out, well, first of all, I will probably write myself right out of that outline at some point, you know, just be like, well, I like this better, but my outline says I have to go over here and now I'm stuck. Or they've told a story. They've told the story. Their brain goes, well, done. I'm done. I don't need to write anymore. And it becomes extremely difficult to move forward after that point. Gotcha. So it's, you know, I do need that process of discovery that people who identify as pantsers talk about. But I also need the structure of an outline. I guess in writing, I am also bi. That's how that works.
Nope, I get it. I think a lot of times that we, human beings, we like our binaries, you know, planner, panster, you know, but everybody's a little bit, everything's a spectrum. Everybody's right. A little bit on there somewhere. It's not fully that.
Yeah.
But we still like, we like to label things. We do love our labels.
We do love our labels. I like to joke that in terms of, you know, in terms of stuff like this, that every single time I've written a book, I've had to teach myself how to write a book. Because every one of these damn little things is different.
Yeah, kind of like kids. One doesn't always prepare you for the next one.
Yep.
Let's see. Some of my questions I've decided I don't like as much after I've written them. One thing I didn't talk to you really about last time, obviously, we know you're an author. What does Jen Lyons like to do when she's not writing? What is your non-writing go-to for fun or just calming?
How much time do you have? My problem is that I have a lot of things that I enjoy doing. I mean, obviously, previously mentioned, tabletop role-playing. I'm a huge reader, so there's that. You know, one of those things led to the other. Reader to writer. I enjoy sewing. I enjoy pyrography. I have a ton of hobbies, right? Just an absolute ton of hobbies. Fountain pens. I've been doing or had been doing, it was mostly a COVID project, but it kind of keeps going on. Different handwriting styles. Playing with learning different handwriting styles. I'm currently working on learning French and Iraqi Arabic. Beadwork. I like beadwork. Jewelry making. Cooking.
I get
probably
it.
I could probably come up with more.
I think you have, not that it's a problem, but kind of the same issue that I have is like, I enjoy too many things, therefore I don't have enough time for anything.
Yep.
Because I want to do everything. I have the same problem with reading. I read pretty much all the genres.
Yeah.
I've decided I'm not a huge romanticy fan, but even then, a good book is a good book.
Right. Yes. I can recommend some fantastic romanticies, even though I'm with you on that one. It's not what I'm going to pick up normally unless Freya Marsk wrote it, in which case I will, because
I
pretty much love everything she's ever written. So
like I read one the other day and the book itself was so good except for the romance part of the tussie. So it's like great author. I had to give her credit. Great author, but I just couldn't get past all that. One of the things that a lot of new time authors don't realize they're going to have to get into unless they go the non-traditional route, right, is the amount of marketing and all the other stuff that you have to do that's not writing. not trying to throw out other names here, but I remember one of the things that Jim Butcher mentioned when he was on was the fact that when I started, I had all this time to write. You know, I got down, I write. Now I've got interviews and I've got, you know, book signings and I've got, you know, some people come up to me. I guess he's a big animal guy. So I've got charity stuff.
Right.
How much time, now that you've been established for a little bit, how much time do you end up finding yourself, you still, even though you're traditionally published, that you still have to kind of do like this? Let's face it, to an extent, as much as you and I enjoy talking about books and stuff, this is marketing, for lack of a better word,
right,
getting that book out there. And is it way, way more than you ever thought it was going to be?
It is way, way more than I ever thought it was going to be. And my experience is, and this is not an insult or a slam. It's just the reality of the situation, which is they will take as much as they can. They being the general public and publicity and marketing and everything else like that. It is up to the author to set boundaries. And if you do not set boundaries, they will not set those boundaries. They will assume everything is fine unless you tell them otherwise. And it's really very difficult for a new author to be like, you know what? No, I can't do this thing. And that's probably been one of the biggest changes this time around compared to with Ruin of Kings coming out, is that I've had to tell them no on things, just because for my own mental health. And, you know, I legitimately do not have the time to do these things. So that's, you know, all feelings about J.K. Rowling aside, there is a quote from her saying, talking about protecting your time, that is pretty spot on. It is, if you don't, as an author, particularly once you have gotten into the traditional publishing space, if you don't protect your writing time, no one else will do it for you.
No, and I get that too. I feel like there's also, as we talked about everything being a spectrum, I feel like there are certain authors that have to learn to say no, like you have, because otherwise they write a book and then they just spend the next 9 months, 12 months doing nothing but promoting it. And there's other ones that almost can't get their publicist or the publishers, like the publisher's not going to spend money on promotion.
Yeah.
So they've got to go out there and find their own promotions.
Yeah. It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Like, you know, on the one hand, I've known a lot of self-published authors who, you spend, anytime you're not writing, you're promoting your work. And, you know, I'm really bad at that. I'm bad at that in all possible ways. Like I have ADHD, and part of ADHD is I tend to hyper-focus on things. And so it can be difficult for me to pull out the, I should be doing this, a little bit of this and a little bit of this and a little bit of this. It tends to be, I'm going to put all of my energy into one thing, 200%, until that thing is done. And that is not necessarily a good thing for marketing with books.
Mm-hmm. So. I feel too, this is one of those things where we have to realize authors are not all cut from the same cloth. I know a few authors that they write a book, they want to talk to everybody about that book. They're so excited about that book, even if it's not their first book.
Right.
And there's other ones, and I think you might fall at least a little bit into this category, is like, okay, I wrote that book. Now I've got this other idea. And the publisher is like, but no, now you have to talk about this book. It's like, I'm done with that book.
I told that story. I'm over here now.
Exactly.
You know,
I think we kind of lit on that last time when you were talking about the fact that, I mean, you were working, and it's been 2 years. I mentioned that earlier. You were working on The Sky on Fire,
right,
2 years ago. It was 20% done, according to your website, the first time we talked.
Yep.
But you were still having to talk about the last book. Oh, and I just dumped it. The Chorus of Dragons, the last book.
Discord of Gods.
Thank you. Which I should have known, because we tried to do it on Discord just because we thought that would be cool and it didn't work.
Yeah.
But you were done with the Discord of Gods. You were working 20% through the Sky and Fire, and you kept having to like say, okay, you know, now I need to go talk about this again.
Right.
When your brain is already, like I said, 20% in, you're into this other world now.
Yeah. Yeah. And right now I'm finishing up a different book, right? You know, same thing. It's
Well, there goes my last question of the night.
No, yes, I am writing
I figured
a different...
you would be.
Yeah, I'm working on a different book. Never stops.
One thing I want to mention now, just because I thought about it after reading, and because I just mentioned that I talked to him, after reading Jim Butcher's The Cinder Spire series, you had mentioned when you were talking about The Sky on Fire, how it was a little Dragon Riders of Pernish. And there were parts in your book, and obviously Cinder Spires had not come out yet at all. But there are parts of your book that very much reminded me of his world that he had built. Because, again, you've got all this stuff built up in the sky. And just kind of the way some of your characters reacted when they had to go down to the earth. Yeah, I'm starting to get into the book now. Let's just face it. And it was that kind of that same feeling. Obviously, 2 years ago, Cinder Spires didn't exist, especially Aeronaut's Cutlet or Olympian Affair. And I feel sometimes this is where authors kind of have the same problem sometimes movies do. It's like, well, this kind of reminds me of this other book. It's like, when I was writing this, that other book didn't exist.
Right. But I mean, this doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me at all. You know, you approach something that is similar in theme and you make similar judgment calls on solutions, you know? And, you know, Jim and I have certain similarities of background. We have a lot of the same favorite authors. It doesn't surprise me that we would make some of the same choices for how we approach these sorts of things.
One question I have to ask you about the book, because I also remember when you likened it to Dragon Riders of Pern, but you also likened it to The Witcher. And I wrote the name down because there were so many names in this. I was going to, was it Varagul when you were talking about the grumpy old man, or was it somebody else you had in mind?
A little bit. Yeah. Okay.
Obviously the book may have changed since then.
Right. And it did. It absolutely did, because these things always change. But you know, mostly, when I was talking about a grumpy person, I was talking about Anorod.
Oh, okay.
Right. Gotcha. You know, so you have this person who is wandering around in the wilderness, surviving by fighting off monsters for whatever village can pay her. And she gets kind of dragged into shenanigans. But yeah, that was sort of where I started on that one. It was like, I kind of wanted a female witcher.
Gotcha. Okay. I think maybe just because of the grumpy old man thing, I locked onto Varagul when I was
Well, he is grumpy, but I don't think he existed at that time.
Gotcha.
I don't think he was.
All right. What was I going to say? Oh, one of the things, since we are, and I'm going to avoid spoilers at all costs here, because the book does not come out until July 9th. One of the things I was going to ask you about the fact, did I lose my train of thought? I may have lost my train of thought. So I'm going to go on to something else that I actually had prepared.
Okay.
One of the things I saw, there were some certain similarities I mentioned between not specific plot lines or anything like that, but for instance, some of your characters in the Chorus of Dragons series had that whole, I don't want to say trans thing because it wasn't exactly that, but that whole, they're on a spectrum. You and I talked about the fact that things are spectrum, not binary.
Right.
And for instance, you know, they were a mare or a stallion, and we kind of went on that thing. But I also found you kind of, I love the fact that you don't actually get into the specifics of it. But definitely in the book, The Sky and Fire, there are characters who change their mind later or who haven't chosen yet. And you don't really get into what that process is, that like one character, without saying who, dad or had two mothers and now they've got a mother and a dad.
Right.
Because one of them changed.
Right.
And I like that you don't get into specifics about how that process actually happened, or at least I don't remember it.
No, I do not get into specifics because it has nothing to do with the story.
Right. But you,
I mean, it has, emotionally has something to do with the story, but it doesn't have to do with the specific plot.
I feel like you very much make these characters and these worlds open to everyone, but without beating somebody over the head with it. I feel like some people are like, I'm putting this in because I feel definite about it and you're going to agree with everything I say.
Right.
And I feel a lot of the story points that you have, they're in the old series. They're also in the new book, but you put them in such a way that they are just part of the story.
Well, I don't want them to be remarkable.
Right.
I don't want them to be remarkable. And I mean, you know, it's very much a write what you know kind of situation. It wasn't until years later I look back on my childhood and my teen years and I think about how many people that I had were friends with, were running around with, who were queer or later on realized were trans. And to me, that's normal. So that is normal representation for me, is that you would have a spectrum of people that have this sort of broad way of looking at gender and sexuality. So, but yeah, no, I didn't want to have a neon sign pointing to any of that. I think I just want it to be there, you know, background.
Exactly. One of the other things I thought carried over, and again, it's not that you did them the same way, but for instance, your dragons are very different in both books from the normal, everyday idea of what a dragon is supposed to be. I feel like your gods in both of them were very different, although the gods were much less touched upon in this book.
Yeah.
I'm sure I can say plural gods on that one. I don't remember, but...
No. It's just Iannis. There's just the one. And, you know, she exists in that world. Well, she doesn't actually exist in that world.
She's
myth. She's purely myth. She's not answering anyone's prayers.
I'll take you for your word for that one. I think you wrote it very well in the fact that as you're reading the book, you're like, does she exist? Or did she exist? Or like, did she just create the world and move on? You left it very, very open.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I wanted to play more in this book with the idea of religion as myth and the idea that history becomes myth and things are distorted and, you know, then become dogma but don't necessarily have a foundational, it doesn't mean it happened exactly the way the stories say they happened.
Right. And you very much touched on the fact that religion such as it is in this world, which doesn't have a huge bearing on a lot of things, very much depends on who's telling you the religion.
It's very much a control mechanism in this world. Yeah. Absolutely. Without question. It is a tool for keeping the people in power. So.
And here's a question. It touches on the book, but I think it also helped writers out there. Some authors, for instance, they have a naming scheme, for lack of a better word. In Course of Dragons, you had a naming scheme for a lot of the families and stuff like that, about how that was written. In The Sky on Fire, the dragons' names are all very, very different, even though they all have that, you know, cool, medieval, fantasy-sounding names. Did you actually have any sort of naming scheme, or were you just like, that's a cool name and I'm going to use it?
Well, I did create a conlang for dragons. I did construct a language for them. There were some problems with it, not least of which is that in my own world building for dragons, an awful lot of dragon speech is outside of the range of human hearing. So any sort of language for that would be, there would have been an awful lot of apostrophes, let's just say. It'd been an awful lot of skipped sections as you were trying to. So after a little while, it did just kind of become, it started off very much, here's a scheme for it. But as it went, it sort of became more, this is a cool sounding dragon name.
Well, I mean, you get too many apostrophes in there and then you have to start, you know, feeling really, really bad for the voice actors who have to do the audiobook.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like Lauren. I would not do that to her. So,
oh man. So this is another one of those, and I feel like you've done this again. It's another one of those things too. There, you have a protagonist, but you definitely don't have the protagonist. You have another ensemble cast, kind of like you did in Chorus of Dragons, where we're kind of following a lot of moving parts here. Even though it's from her point of view, you have a huge cast of regular characters, not just one-offs, to keep straight. And I will tell you, and again, I don't want to get into specifics, some of your characters, and I know I told you Talon was my favorite in the Chorus of Dragons. This one, I think it has to be kind of, it's Claw. And I know, notice there's also a name similarity there, but I'm not going to get into that. But as you do a great job of going through a story and you give characters certain traits, and then you kind of, as the story goes along, you start to find out why certain characters are certain way. And I, as horrible as it is, I love Claw's backstory, and it really explained her relationship. And again, these are fantasy names, so tell me if I say anything wrong. Is it Kyben?
Kyben.
Oh, I missed the R. So their relationship, I mean, that was very, very touching.
You have two very broken, damaged people who are trying to prop each other up. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And
one's doing it better than the other, but,
yes. And I will admit that those were the two characters that my editors kept wanting me to cut. Right.
No.
Those were the two that they kept like, you know, we don't really see where they're needed. And I just was like, okay, first of all, this is a heist. This is a heist story, mm-hmm. and heist stories have crews, and you don't get to tell a proper heist story without crews. So this style of heist story, there's other styles of heist story, but so no, they are in fact important. But then there's also just the fact that I wasn't going to cut them. But that's okay, because to my mind, whenever anybody tells me that you've got characters that aren't important to the story and can be cut, that just means I haven't done my work convincing you otherwise. And I need to double down on that. It doesn't mean that, you know, that they're wrong. It just means that I need to sell it better. And I think by the end, I think I sold it pretty well. That
you did. I want to say thank you for ignoring whoever told you to cut them, because not only is their story arc and the thing my favorite, I really feel like Claw especially was needed. Otherwise, it kind of becomes you're almost stuck with the love triangle there,
right?
And it almost becomes right. You're leaning towards romantic now.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm telling you, every time Claw says something to the lines of "not trying to, boss," I just had to laugh.
Yeah, she is very intentionally not friendly, and she, you know, violence is her love language. So, I mean, you know, it's definitely one of those things where if you moved 2 feet out of line to hurt people she cares about, she would. Well, she's very protective. So she's protective of the people that are important to her. And she's not going to admit some of the people that are important to her, because that's not, she would never do that. But
she's not a touchy feeling.
No.
She's a touchy pokey.
Yes, exactly. Touchy pokey.
If she gives you a hug, check your back for knives.
Or possession. I mean, you know, like she's been possessed by something, because that's mm-hmm. not a thing she would normally do. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed how those two characters evolved and came along as the story progressed. But I mean, that's part of, you know, even though I knew that Anarod was going to be the main POV character and Riss was going to be the main plot driver. Again, heist stories always have this ensemble cast that's doing stuff around to further the story. And, you know, mm-hmm. that had to be the case here too.
I think that tied into something else. I was trying to remember earlier when I was telling you that there were certain things that I found similar between both sets of books, for lack of a better word, even though they weren't the exact same. But the fact that your characters, I feel, in The Sky and Fire, a lot of them weren't who we thought they were. Sicarion, for instance, you start the book having you feel a very certain way about him.
Right.
And by the end of the book, he's not the same. He's not the same guy you had in your head, at least.
Right. Right. Well, that's very me. That's very me. I like to.
Well, I also think it said a lot about Anarod too.
Yeah. Well, Anarod didn't know who Anarod was. So, you know, there was a lot of self-discovery that needed to happen there.
Right. I just feel Anarod was definitely giving you her side of the story at the beginning.
Yeah.
And you had not heard his side of the story yet, because I don't think she'd listen to his side of the story, to be honest with you.
No, I don't think she really had. Well, I mean, I think she thought she knew. Mm-hmm. She thought she knew what was going on. So that was all she needed.
See, and I'm always impressed that a writer can write that character in that way, because the author knows everything. But you have to write each character as if they only know their piece of the puzzle.
Well, that's part of where plot happens, right?
It is.
Is in the things that people don't know, and or the things people assume, you know, and that's where you get some of the tragic moments too in various stories, is when, you know, the readers know a thing that if only the character knew, everything could be okay. But Sicarion was a little bit of a rebel wild child, even in writing, where he had a much smaller part initially, like kind of a background mention almost part, bit character part. And he just kind of kept pushing his way in until he was no longer a bit character. But that's okay. That's okay. Yeah.
I think I enjoyed what was the thing towards the end there. You had him in that outfit that was basically made of like leaves or something that was like was strips together, but they weren't really connected, but they never quite gapped enough for you to see anything interesting. Something about how you wrote that I thought was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely did go similarities with other books. He definitely did go to the Tirith school of fashion. But also, I mean, that was just a coming from a very culturally different, how you would dress in a jungle setting where, you know, it's,
hot and humid.
I think 1.9 atmospheres at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a kind of humidity you can't even begin to imagine, as well as being, you know, ungodly hot. Yeah, maybe clothing is different.
I do have to say this. I didn't think about it until you said it, but Sicarion, now that you mentioned that, I think he also went to the Tirith School of Confidence and possibly questionable morals. You know, death is okay as long as it depends on who we're killing, you know, that type of thing.
I mean, Sicarion is kind of this guy who, again, I'm trying not to spoiler too much, but I think it gets brought up early enough. You know, he's done a bunch of adventuring, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's a warlord, he's conquered, and he's in the middle of still conquering. You don't get to be in that position if you're not comfortable with violence.
Right.
So, you know, he doesn't have Tirith's relationship with his mom, thankfully.
No.
And in fact, honestly, Sicarion has his head on way more straight than Tirith does.
True, but I can sit down for a beer together. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, fair. But yeah, no, Sicarion is more mature, right? And that's kind of true of a lot of these characters. You know, he's not a young something. He's done stuff. He's older. And that has an impact, right? You know,
I would just think it's kind of sad that he's more mature considering how long T'Raith had actually been alive.
Yeah, that's a difference between memories and hormones, though, yeah, and the plasticity of a body that's still only 20, you know.
I will give you that. I can't imagine. People always talking about, like, if they knew now, if they could have known now when they were younger. And I'm thinking, I don't know how much of a difference that would make, because we still, especially young guys, we listen to our hormones way too much.
It's not just guys. It's
not just true, but as a guy, I'm not going to throw any women under the bus. That'll just get me ran over. I know how this works.
I think that's just a human condition. But yeah, so going back to things that are the same, again, don't want to spoiler too much stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say, so very early on in the series, or when I started talking about Sky on Fire, people asked me if it was the same world as A Course of Dragons. And I said, no. And that is true. It's obviously, clearly not the same world as A Course of Dragons.
Right.
It is the same universe.
Oh, okay.
It is literally another planet in another solar system in the same universe. So if you scrape away all the trappings and the fact that people in this world learned magic in a completely different way than the people of Omphir, the magic system is actually the same.
Gotcha.
So if you squint and you look at it, you can realize that some of the stuff that's happening is the same as that other series. But why the dragons are here and why humanity's here and just all of the sorts of different things, this is very much a different world.
Gotcha. No, that tracks. Oh, that was the other thing I was thinking of when I was talking about some similarities. Although, again, it's one of those things where it's similar, but you didn't handle it the same way at all. Is, again, you do touch on at least the idea of reincarnation in the Sky on Fire. It's not quite as in your face as Chorus of Dragons, but again, it's there. It is a background subject, you know, possibility.
Well, because it is the same universe and the same systems are at play. It's just that on this world, there are no guardians, there are no god kings, there's no one to pierce the veil and pull everyone's attention to the fact that there is a second world and that people can come back around. So most of the time, why would you ever know? How would you ever know?
Sure.
You know? So, you know, yeah, people can get reincarnated, but no one's gonna know it because the mechanisms to remember it don't exist.
And that's, I think, is one of the things I loved about The Sky on Fire, though, is as you're reading it, if you've read The Chorus of Dragons, you're kind of getting, you're seeing the similarities, you're kind of getting almost like an Easter egg type thing reading the book, but you're never getting like, oh, this is just such and such again.
Right.
You the things that you do touch on, yes, those concepts come back into play, but they're handled completely different between what I'm going to hope is going to be a series. Without getting spoilery, I will say that this is one of the few books that I've read where not only, because almost every author gives themselves the option for a sequel, I think the way we're dropped into this story, you very much have opened up, not asking you if you're going to, unless you want to say it, but I can actually see a prequel coming to this book too. And I don't normally like prequels, but you have some stories that we know happened, but we don't know the specifics of, is like, I could be hooked into a prequel for that.
Yeah, there's definitely some prequel possibilities. Some of those would just be short stories, you know, because they're not. And so I'm not sure I have the mental fortitude to tackle the early days, because oof, that would be dark. That would be very, very, very dark when humanity first showed up. But you know, it's a whole world, and whole worlds have a lot of space to do stuff in. And if, you know, I think it's more interesting to not, it's the iceberg thing, you know?
Right.
Just show a little bit. You don't necessarily need to have everything that has gone on in the world on the page. It's often more powerful if you don't.
Fair enough. As much as I say, and I told you I don't like romantasy, but as much as I kind of feel like I would love seeing now, because you have to read this first, but then to read a prequel where you go back and see, for instance, Inari and Sakaarion, I gave her her short name, sorry, Anarad and Sakaarion's, you know, history.
Right.
And I think that would make a cool short story. I do agree with you that there are times when I've seen things where you take the mystery away. Think filling in Wolverine's background in the comics. He doesn't have that mystery anymore. He's not the same guy. Or do you ever watch Spencer for Hire back in the day?
I did. Yeah.
Do you remember that brief spinoff called A Man Called Hawk?
Yes, I do remember that.
And it just wasn't the same because the whole thing about Hawk is that he was a man of mystery, but to give him his own series, you've got to flesh him out. And it's I just like the cool guy with the giant gun and the beamer that I think he drove in a BMW.
Is
like,
the problem is that Hawk is not a main character.
No, he's meant
it's just
to be
like, a yeah, it's just like, God, what, Highlander, the series, right? I don't know if you ever watched that.
I watched some of it.
They tried to make, there was a recurring female character, and they tried to give her own. She was kind of a Catwoman kind of character. She was a jewel thief, and she'd done all these really interesting things. And I get that, but she was not a main character. And so needless to say, that didn't, you have to be careful who you pull off and give the spotlight to, because some characters don't, can't carry that weight.
Yeah, not everybody can pull them off of Mork and Mindy, where it's like it was a one-off character, and then they got their own show.
Right.
Most of the times, it doesn't turn out that well.
Yeah. No, agreed. And sometimes it's, you know, like people have asked me a lot if I would ever write the Affair of the Voices, which is this very, it's the term that I was using for this period of time in the first book in. When you know all this stuff happened, and you know, Tyenso, just stuff like it's very significant in terms of present day events, but there's a lot of mystery as to exactly what went down when, you know, that happened. And I was like, no, God, no. Amongst other things, how horribly depressing would that ending be? You know everything went wrong. Mm-hmm. You know everything went horribly wrong. Like, there's no happy endings there for anybody.
So, that's kind of the downside of a prequel too, is the fact that at least to a certain extent, you lose the suspense, because there are certain characters, if it's a normal prequel, we know they're going to be alive at the end of the book.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it can be done well. I think, sorry, back of my edges, but I think, I mean, it can be done well. You just have to be careful. You know, I always think about the early seasons of the TV show Smallville, right? Which is technically a prequel, right? Sure. You know how it's going to turn out, and you're sitting there shouting at the TV because freaking Lex Luthor is so amazing, and if Clark would just, and his damn dad would just stop being so stupid, you know, like the tragedy of how they could have been friends gave that more depth than it otherwise would have. So, I mean, you know, there are ways in that you can take a prequel where you know how it's going to turn out and have that work to your benefit, because you can write it in such a way that hopefully your reader is upset about the way it's going to turn out. You know, doesn't want it to turn out that way, instead of just being bored by the idea.
I'm only going to bring this up because the fact that you just talked Smallville, because I just happened to listen to an episode of Talkville the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the fact that you didn't know this at the time, but I almost blanked on his name. Tom Welling was saying the fact that even though that was a 10-year show, they knew from the very get-go that it wasn't going to be until the final episode that you would see him actually wear the suit.
Right.
The whole idea is that it was supposed to be before he became the Man of Steel. It's also one of the reasons that he doesn't fly, even though you know he can fly.
Right.
But he's afraid of heights in the TV show. But yeah, you're right. There are certain things that you, doesn't matter how he feels about Lana Lang, you know he's not going to end up with her.
Right.
It doesn't matter how he feels about Lex Luthor, you know they're going to end up being enemies.
Yep. But that makes it emotionally more poignant.
True. They handled it well. I will give Smallville this. Yes, if you go back and watch the first few seasons, you realize how bad the special effects were at the time.
Oh, yeah.
The first two seasons, at least, they had the whole Freak of the Week thing going on.
Yeah, it was definitely Freak of the Week.
Every week. But they really hit their stride, and they did a good job with it. But we're talking to Jen Lyons right now. So I just thought that it was funny that you brought that up. I literally listened to that episode yesterday.
I think the same trap exists the other way, right? Anytime you have a series and then an epic fantasy like this, and then you try to set something 20 years later, that is a trap of its own, right? Where you either need to have everything. We saw this, I'm going to keep using movies as and TV shows as, but we saw this with Star Wars, right? Part of the reason that everyone was, there were so many extreme opinions about episodes 7, 8, 9 was because in order to give it a story, in order to have there be a conflict, they had to have everything fall apart. They had to have everything, all of the accomplishments meant nothing. They had to walk everything back, right?
Right.
So suddenly everything they fought and strived and, you know, suffered for was undone by the next generation. And it's hard to take that and move it forward in a good way. Maybe that's just my own personal pet peeves, but I certainly know, I can think of other series, fantasy series, where that is was the pitfall as well. Is like you have to, you either run the risk of we've seen this or we've read this book, we've read exactly this book before. I think David Eddings even made a joke about it, that the second run through the second series sequel to the Belgariad was effectively just the same thing as the first. You end up with something where, you know, you end up doing what readers and audiences will view as character assassination in order to get the story in such a state of conflict that you can then move forward in a Star Wars-y way or in a epic fantasy way.
Right. Because it's hard to have that good tension if you start all over again. And everything was great. And we're going to have another story now.
Yeah. And I think it could have been done, but I don't think it could have been done with them trying so hard to recreate Star Wars.
Sure.
Right? I think it needed to have been... you look at the movies that have really succeeded, or the TV shows from that, you know, the thing that have really succeeded, Rogue One, The Mandalorian, they were not trying to recreate Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, Mandalorian, you could argue it just happened to take place in the universe. It really didn't care about the rest of it.
It's a Western, you know? Absolutely. I mean, you know, Wolf and Cub also, you know, it's also a samurai movie, but, it definitely was not trying to be Star Wars. I don't know where we got onto this.
Sequels and prequels.
Talking about the, the sequel possibilities and how you have to be careful about things. But certainly I've put a lot of thought into, if I ever write a sequel to A Chorus of Dragons, there's still an awful lot of things wrong in the world that did not get fixed. In fact, they've caused problems that they don't realize they've caused, fairly significant problems. So there's room there, you know, if I wanted to do something later. And for Sky on Fire, there's definitely room for stuff. It won't be, any sequels won't be heist stories.
Fair enough. Yeah, you kind of use the heist up. It's not really designed for that. I do have to say, if it hadn't been for the, I can't remember, was it a epilogue or was it just the final chapter? You kind of had it to a point where it's like, okay, we can cut this off here or we could do a sequel. And then you kind of did that final bit and I'm like, okay, now I'm feeling sequel.
You
did that to set it up so you could do a sequel.
A little bit of that, I just couldn't leave it without knowing, without demonstrating what that character was up to, because
we say spoiler
because free. They're a gremlin, and
so
yeah, again, without spoilers.
Yep. Again, you and your characters who aren't what we think they are.
Yeah. And he's a good example of that, because I had an awful lot of people when they first reading that make comparisons to, I think specifically, and this is not going to be this big a deal, specifically to Galen. And I was like, no, not even a little bit. Nope. And by the end of the book, they were like, oh, yeah, no.
I feel like, obviously, most authors, you've got your alpha or at least beta readers.
Yeah.
And as much as I know people didn't like Go Set a Watchman because it was actually the original thing for To Kill a Mockingbird, I feel like as a person, I would love to be, for lack of a better word, like an Omega reader. It's like, I want to read the book. And then I want to go back to what did that first draft look like? Because every author I've ever talked to will say, the first draft is not what you're reading in print.
No, the first draft is you trying to figure out what your story even is. And then you have to go and actually tell the story. The first draft is you regurgitating it all on the page. It's not coherent, and it's usually awful in many different ways. This is why editors are so wonderful. It's because you need that person to be like, is that really how you want to do this?
I think my curiosity interest is more the fact that probably every author that we've actually touched on this subject is either got a character that was almost nobody in the original draft, and now they're like a main plot point.
Yeah.
Or who was it? I think I was talking to Nat Cassidy, and he's like, this was originally a cast thing. I had a whole slew of characters, and by the time he was done with Nestlings, it was basically just about that family.
Right.
And it's like he paired everybody back. And it's like, I'm always curious to like see this, like, who is this character now that we get to read, but who was this character when they were first thought up?
Right. Right.
And obviously I know there are some people that are going to would read something like, oh, they'd be so disappointed that either I can't believe this is what they used to be. Or they're like, I can't believe you got rid of so-and-so. But me, just a curiosity, I would love to read it and not be mad at the author.
I can tell you that the character we were just discussing does not change.
Oh, okay.
He was like that from the very start. And the main character really, for the most part, doesn't change either.
That I could see. The other one, the fact that you liken them to Galen, as where that character starts in the book. Sorry if anybody watches this and I'm gonna like totally mess with them, but who they're gonna be trying to figure out who it is now. But the fact that you have made them, like you said, they're kind of like Galen, kind of like the gremlin thing going on. The fact that you started out with that process and that you had to write that through the entire book, and it's not just something you came along on, because you played the long game with that character.
Yes. But then, you know, he's the smartest guy in the room.
But he also doesn't. But he doesn't always let you know, though, which is more than some do. Galen, for instance, would have wanted you to know that he was the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah, yeah.
Best guy, best looking, strongest, most powerful.
Well, I mean, he would have wanted Darzan to be proud of him, and so you know, you gotta brag about that to make Dad proud. Later, he would have cared less, right. Our mystery person prefers it that you don't know. he likes to keep that close to the chest. And I always knew that, because he's, if you look back on it, right, he and Riss are the ones who spark everything off.
Right.
And sure, they both have their own different reasons, and his reasons are much cuddlier than hers.
Or so we think. Riz was another interesting character. I don't think there's going to be any spoilers on there because it's early on, but
yeah,
Riz basically is this character that is, you know, part paladin and part femme fatale. You know, kind of she knows exactly that she has your attention. She's not one of those that doesn't know how pretty she is.
No, she knows exactly how pretty she is. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
She knows exactly how she's affecting you.
Yep. Yep. And she's doing it very intentionally. Yeah. No, Riss is very much kind of, femme fatale is a good way of describing her, with, you know, a little bit of, she definitely has her own agenda for why she's doing what she's doing. And she's a complicated character, I'll just say.
Exactly. And without going into any details, because people are going to have to find it out as they read the book. But when you get to the part about how she and Perilon managed to bond there, it's like, okay, yeah. She's not just a pretty face. She's got some brains in there, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most people wouldn't have thought to try to do something like that.
Yeah, no, she's definitely an interesting character. And I like her a lot. I like her for her flaws. I like her for her ambitions. I mean, she's held it together for a very long time to get what she wants. So,
and publicly too, it's hard to pull off being a person with a certain background publicly, and nobody figures it out. So,
yep. Right. There's a lot of people wearing masks in this book, sometimes literally.
Yeah, so some of them don't even realize they're wearing masks, I don't think. No. All right, so we have been going about an hour. I know it's like 8 o'clock over on your side there.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a few more questions I want to ask. Downside of talking about a book before it drops is there's only so many questions you can ask without giving anything away.
Yeah.
So let's go into a few of the questions that I always ask everybody towards the end. Kind of touched on this one earlier, but do you have any secret skills or abilities that you wish people would talk to you about instead of always talking about writing? Black belt ninjutsu.
I studied Krav Maga for a while.
Oh, well, there we go. That's close enough. Yeah.
Not really. The hobbies are hobbies. I still draw, but I don't do it as a living anymore.
Oh yeah, I forgot to ask you about that, because I don't actually, of course, I have the arc, so I can't tell for sure, but I know, for instance, in Chorus of Dragons, you did a lot of the chapter art.
I did not this time.
Did not.
I did not do the chapter art.
Because again, I've got the arc, so this may not have everything.
No, as far as I know, actually, the arc is very faithful.
Okay.
There's some the usual typo corrections and things like that have to be. Yeah, that was not me. That was Tor. They did a wonderful job on the topography on that book. I'm really very impressed with it. I did do the maps, though.
Gotcha. Now I'm not going to be able to find it. I was very thankful that Tor accidentally sent me a second copy of the Ark. I don't know if I can find it now, but I'm sitting here reading and I was getting towards the end of the book. Oh yeah. And I started getting started getting pages like this.
Oh goodness.
Yeah. And so it's just like, I'm missing half the page. And then I'm like, wait, they sent me a second arc. Cause like I said, by that time it wasn't till the end. And I'm looking through and I was like, oh, this one's got all the words.
Yeah. Yeah. Whoops.
Yeah. I was like, oh my goodness. But I appreciated that. Also, another thing that I like to ask everybody, you kind of already touched on this, unlike previous times, which I already knew about the Sky on Fire, what can you tell us about what you're currently working on, if anything?
I am working on a book the working title is Green and Deadly Things, and which don't expect that to happen. That was actually the really weird thing about the Sky on Fire was that was the working title.
Oh.
Because, I mean, you know, with A Course of Dragons, there was always, for every book, you know, we would go through like 20 to 40 different options, different variations on things before we would set upon a title. And that was just how it is. And so I kept expecting the letter from them saying, okay, let's figure out what the title of the book is. And it never happened. And I was just like, you're just going with it. Oh, okay, cool. Wonderful. So who knows with Green and Deadly Things if that'll be the case or not. But that one is going to be completely removed. Not the same universe, not anything to do with the others. It's still going to be a fantasy, and it is I'll just say that my joking title for it is Plants vs. Zombies.
Ah, well, there we go. That might tell us a little bit about it already.
Yeah, it's about he's not a knight. He's actually kind of a hasn't ever qualified to be a knight, all but washed out, who accidentally maybe wakes up a infamous evil necromancer. As you do.
Some mistakes are bigger than others.
It
is good to know, though, that at least one thing, as you have jokingly said before, one thing survived contact with the enemy.
Yes.
You've got a title past them, if nothing else.
Yep. I think probably the most notable thing about Green and Deadly Things is going to be that so far, no dragons. Not a one. I know.
I'm going to have to change my title for you. You won't be the Duchess of Dragons anymore. She's like, I know I hated that title in the first place. You quit making things up. All right. And this one, this could be, I'm pretty sure I asked you this one last time. It can be the same answer. I don't care, but I do this at the end of every interview. Shout out to a brick and mortar bookstore of your choice.
Oh, goodness. I'm going to shout out to two. Eagle Eye Books I think, Indie Bookstore Week, isn't it? I think it is.
Was it last week? Don't quote me on that.
I think it's this week. But whatever. Eagle Eye Books in Decatur, Georgia. And that is actually where I'm going to have a release party on July 9th. So I think it's 7 p.m. there. And then Read It Again Books in Johns Creek, which I will be at a few days later. But both of those bookstores are amazing. They've been very supportive. I love them.
Gotcha. It might have been. I'm finding multiple. I tried to Google that real fast, and I found multiple multiple possible answers. So it might be Indie Bookstore Week. I apologize. I used to work at an independent bookstore, and I would know this off the top of my head, but I don't anymore. And as always, I'm doing this differently now. This is live casting to YouTube, but I will get, probably by tomorrow, I will get the links to both of those bookstores down at the bottom.
Wonderful.
So that people can just click and go check them out. I don't think I've got anything new and exciting. The only other question I ask everybody these days, is there a question that you either expected or simply wanted to answer that you did not get asked?
I try not to try to go into these things open-minded. I probably could have gone on, rambled on a little bit more about the world building.
Gotcha.
Because I quite enjoyed doing the world building on for this.
Well, I'll remember that for the next time. I actually did have a question about world building on here, but I felt like I kind of touched on it with the D&D question. And I try not to ask you the exact same question that everybody asked you. Downside is that means I do miss some sometimes.
Yeah, this had, like I said, nothing to do with D&D. So
no, I know.
Yeah, it was sometimes extremely challenging because some of the things I had to try to figure out. I will say this, which is that somebody once asked me what the difference is between, because I also write science fiction, even though nothing as yet has ever been published on my science fiction. But if I approached world building differently between science fiction books and fantasy books, and I truthfully told them, no, I do the world building exactly the same.
Interesting. Yeah, you threw me there for a second because when you said sci-fi, I was like, wait, did I miss a book by her?
No, you've not missed a book.
But we'll keep an eye out. Maybe someday we'll get a sci-fi book.
I like my sci-fi books. Someday, I'd love that.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess it probably does not have a mechanical dragon, but I can always hope.
It does have a dragon, though.
Ah, okay. But not, we're not getting Mechagodzilla there.
You're not getting Mechagodzilla, no.
Well, as always, Jen, I totally appreciate talking to you. Glad you stopped in. I didn't see any questions in the chat. Actually, that makes me want to do something just to verify, because I should have checked this earlier. And I
I'm feeling very like only person on the screen at the moment.
Did I by sometimes accidentally back button? Yes, I did. Nobody saw a thing. I am a professional. Do not do this at home.
All right.
Can you hear me? Am I back?
Yes, okay. I can hear you. Yes. You're all good.
I was like, I just turned myself off there. I don't know what I'm doing here.
Hey, Paul.
Oh, ha, Paul. Sure, stay quiet until now. I was going to feel stupid if we got to the end of this thing and it wasn't actually showing, but
that would have been awkward. Yeah, a little bit. Just
hanging out quiet in the chat. Yeah, he and I are actually going to be talking on Saturday. I think we picked a time. I came late. I felt silly. Don't worry about it.
Fortunately, this will be on YouTube.
Yeah, including since it's live, everybody gets to see my screw up too. So that's perfect. All right. But again, wanted to thank you for hopping in, Jen. Paul, thanks for hanging out and watching.
My pleasure.
Totally looking forward to the next book. I've not read a book of yours yet that I don't like, but as I told you before, I liked Course of Dragons. I loved The Sky on Fire. It's not only everything that you said 2 years ago that it was going to be, but it was even better than I was expecting, and I already had high expectations, which makes it very difficult, because the higher expectations you go in, the harder it is to meet them. You knock this one out of the park. July 9th, correct?
July 9th.
Everybody can get a copy?
Absolutely.
All right. And that is it. Paul, I'll talk to you on Saturday.